Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Well, welcome to Walls in Our Minds. I was finally able to get in with my cell phone instead of my Skype tonight. Apparently, the number that they've had for the host pin in the past has changed, and I was getting a fast, busy signal on the new one, and I hope everybody can hear me. If you can hear us live now, please post a comment in chat saying, yeah, we hear you, or just let us know you're listening, please. Because I do see Chuck Charles in chat there, and we've got a guest, and this is Terry Dodd, and I'm here with my co-host, Red Beckman. Red, are you on live?
I'm here.
Well, good. I see that we've got somebody that's called in, but I don't believe our guest is with us yet. I may end up having to give him a call. Problem is, I'm not on Skype, so I can't conference like I usually do. I think what I'll do is I'll try to call in on Skype and see if it'll let me in. Because I'm watching the switchboard tonight. Our producer, Dr. Kate, is out on other business, and so I'm having to play the dual role tonight of producer and host. So, Red, while I'm working on some of this, why don't you go ahead and open us with a prayer?
I'll be glad to do that. Heavenly Father, we consider this a high privilege to communicate with our fellow Americans, our countrymen, with people all over the world, perhaps, where they can tap in with their computers and such. We thank you because truth is a scarce commodity in our world today, and we pray that you would help us to value truth, put a high value on truth, and communicate that truth to our fellow people out there, people that have been hammered with a lot of propaganda and lies, and our world is in a mess because of all the propaganda and such. And we just pray that you would help us to be a force against that which is so evil. We want to be what you would have us to be, and of course we know that you are mindful of us. And we thank you for that. We thank you because you are watching over us. You're doing a better job of it than NSA, and we just thank you for that. We pray now that you would bless our program tonight, and we'll give you the praise for everything in Christ's name. Amen.
Amen. Well, Red, I know both of us are excited about tonight's show. I don't know that how many of our listeners are really familiar with some of the alternative power potential generators and power sources that there are out there other than just wind and solar. I mean, everybody's heard of that, but they're not really familiar with the magnetic power generators or the pulse units or the plasma units or the hydrogen units or the HHO units or a lot of this stuff. So I'm really excited about Russell Anderson joining us, and I hope he's not having a problem getting in the way that I did. I was really struggling to get on the switchboard and get the show started. So I hope that was just peculiar to me and not to others. There's Russell right now. I believe he's on the switchboard. I'm going to give him a live microphone. Russell Anderson.
Jim Cook.
Welcome to Walls in Our Minds, Russell.
No, you unmuted me, Jim Cook, or Doug Millar.
Oh, I did?
Yeah.
Well, that's okay. Are you simulcasting with us tonight, Doug?
Yes, we are.
Well, I saw your number. Your prefix is 434, and our guest is 484. So I misread it and thought that was him. But so I will mute you back. Hit a one if you'd like to join the conversation. Okay, Doug?
Sure.
Well, okay. Like I said, I may have to try to patch Russell Anderson in. I hope that he's not having those problems. At any rate, I met the I got familiar with Searle, John Searle, who's been around the high tech community for many, many decades. He's an old gentleman really now, but very, very brilliant. One of those kind of guys when he starts talking, some people get the deer in the headlights kind of look on their face because they don't have a clue what he's talking about, because he's generally way over a lot of people's heads. But this guy back in the 40s built a magnetic generator that when he powered that thing up, it actually flew, actually took off. It repelled itself from the earth. And I got to meet a lot of these the Searle team, the guys that work with his company here in the United States. Searle himself is actually still over in I believe Great Britain. And when I met these guys, I was fascinated because I knew what they'd been up to, and some of these guys had been working with him for quite some time, and actually had built some of these discs, these flying discs. They look just like a flying saucer. As a matter of fact, I suspect that some of the photographs that people have taken of flying saucers or put them out there have actually been these flying discs that were developed by Searle. I think he's made over 40 of them, something like 42 of them. And they're all flown by remote control. They're not actually manned vehicles, and the reason they're not is because it'd be very expensive to put a man inside one, because there's no air inside the magnetic field that is formed, which actually is what repels from the earth. That magnetic field that's formed when that generator fires up allows you to defeat gravity, if you will. It actually repels itself. And but they know how to steer them and fly them, and you can actually put a life support system inside of one, which I'm sure somebody's done somewhere, whether it was the Germans or Russians or us or who. But the ones that they've built have actually been a remote control, just because of the expense of putting a life support system inside of one of these things. And I was told it's really an interesting thing, because when I know that John Searle one time grabbed one of these while it was in flight, while it was still on, with his hands around the outer edge of it, and nearly froze his hands off, from what I understand, because of the negative energy coming off of there will freeze, human tissue or live tissue. So it's very interesting, and certainly answers a lot of questions that we've had over the years, and some of the craziness that has been associated with alien intelligence and that sort of thing. And I'm not saying one way or another about that. I'm just saying that a lot of the things that have been speculated on are not everything that has been represented. Red, I know that you've been looking into magnetic power for a while. What's your take on this? I mean, we've got a lot of expense that's been put out there in wind and solar, and it really has not been as effective as people would like. For one, obviously, it's subject to weather conditions, but it's also been very expensive. And some of it's actually created problems, like with the wind generators. They've gotten a lot of friction and a lot of wear. it has some environmental hazards to it regarding wildlife. It's actually started some fires. What has drawn you to the magnetic power generating? Because I know that you've looked into this. I know that you've seen some things in the past that you thought worked. If you could maybe address that for just a few minutes, I will try to get our guests on the phone.
I will try. And of course, if we're going to go that route, we're going to have to talk about. You remember Alfred Lawson? Now he talked about the alien financiers.
Yeah.
Anyway. The major power companies, well, I'm out here on the West Coast right now, and I'm not too far from the Columbia River. In fact, the Columbia River's less than a half a mile from my house. And there's all those dams on the Columbia River, and it used to be that out here on the West Coast, anywhere near the Columbia River, people had a very, very low cost on their power. And it has been creeping up and creeping up and getting higher and higher and higher. And I hear a common complaint here amongst the population here, and they're saying they took our tax money and they built those dams using our tax money to do that. Then we generate the power. We paid for those generators. We paid for the dams. We paid for everything, the taxpayers. And, of course, now the Bonneville Power, that's a federal agency, I guess, and they're demanding more money all the time for the power. And so these people out here, a lot of them are really squirming and complaining about the fact of what they're paying for their power right now. And they say, we paid for those dams, we paid for those generating units, and all. Now we're having to pay this high price for power. We know that there's political forces out there that are trying their best to somehow cut back on the amount of power available. They want to tear out three or four dams on the River in Northern California and Southern Oregon and the Klamath River. They want to take those dams out, and they all generate power. And it's false science. They say they've got to restore the salmon runs in the Klamath River. And the Klamath River has never had a salmon run in it. And so it's there's some Agenda 21 stuff going on and one thing and another. And it's these alien financiers that Alfred Lawson would tell us about in his books and such from way back. And so I have known a few technical people in my life, and I've had different ones say there's several ways to generate power to where we could have power right in our home, or we could have something out in our backyard or something that would generate all the electricity that we would need in our home. I know one gentleman, he was an engineer, and he said, I know of at least six or seven ways that you can generate power, and for your own use and all the power you would need. Well, this is getting pretty attractive. I talked to a gentleman today, and his electric bill is about $300 a month. I have an outdoor wood-burning furnace that heats the hot water, and we have all the hot water we want to use, and we use lots of it. And we heat our place, our house. It's not a big house, only about 1,500 or 1,600 square feet, because the missus and I at our age, why, we've downsized considerable. And our power bill with that just that wood-burning furnace out there. There's no generator or anything, but our house is heated with hot water coming from that wood-burning furnace. I have lots and lots of wood, and so my power bill is less than $50 a month, so I'm kind of the envy of a lot of my neighbors and such here because my power bill isn't so high. But my son in Boise, Idaho, it's running, I think, about $300 a month in the wintertime. And, of course, it's not down very much because Boise, Idaho is a hot city, and they have to use air conditioning in the summertime. They need a lot of it. And so we're coming to a point where people are being squeezed. They're being... is there somebody else on now?
Yes, we have Russell. Russell on with us, but go ahead and finish your statement, Red.
Yeah, well, it's just I've said enough, I guess, already, but we've come to a point where people are being punished, you know, for using too much power and such, and all that power, we know it's available. And so that has motivated people to think and people to create. And that's something that our Heavenly Father wants us to do because we were created in His likeness. He is a creative power, and you and I were to be creative as well. And so if you have your guest, let's go.
Well, let's introduce Russell Anderson, the CEO of Searle Aerospace. Russell, welcome to Walls in Our Minds.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Well, if you're, did you get a hold of your buddy Brad or one
yeah,
of those guys?
Yeah, I was just talking a second ago. He's on his way out. I can't get him.
Well, we're sure glad to have you here. It certainly was a pleasure meeting you and the rest of your team at the Global Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference in Boulder here just a few months ago. I guess it was nearly 2 months ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was 2 months ago, back around the middle of October. And
well, that was a great conference.
Yeah, it was a great conference, and it was a sold-out conference, and we got to do... that was the second conference that I did, the second Global Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference. First one I did last November in Hilversum, Holland, and that was my first time in Holland, and that was hugely successful. So they invited us back, and the first one I talked about, I was really a replacement for John Bedini. They couldn't get John Bedini, so Fernando Bosa got me in to talk about magnetic motors. And, of course, one of the most famous magnetic motors is a Searle effect generator, or SEG. And I talked about that and the fact that when you overload it, it doesn't want to stay on the Earth. The Earth repels it with irresistible force. So I included some stuff about the IGV and various things like film clips and history and of the IGV. And this conference this past year, I did the IGV. I did Biofield Brown. Electrostatic propulsion, electrogravitic propulsion, and work that I'd done in that area over the years, and, of course, the Searle inverse gravity generator, which generates its own gravity field when it's overloaded and superconducting, at which point the Earth or any source of gravity repels it with irresistible force. And, you know, it's fascinating. It's, as they say, the only way to fly. 42 flight vehicles from 1953 to 1978, and just a fantastic technology utilizing the Searle effect generator, which, of course, is a zero-point energy tapper. It's a Maxwell demon, as they say. It coheres the zero-point energy through magnetics and vortexian action.
Well, before we get into all of that technical stuff, tell us a little bit about yourself so that the folks here can have a little bit of an idea of just, you know, how you got into this and how long you've been doing it and what really was stirred your interest in it to start with.
Oh, gosh. Well, a bit of a long story. I've always been interested in things that fly and outer space and space transportation and space transportation systems. And I guess I got into it when I started getting into UFO propulsion and UFO flight methodologies, which of course are non-conventional and way over Unity. They tap the zero point. They're not using internal combustion for propulsion. And I realized after I started my study of UFOs in 1968-69, when I was a little kid, that if we ever wanted to go into space in reasonable time and economy, that it wasn't going to be done with rocketry and internal combustion or even nuclear NERVA rockets or solar sails or anything conventional. It was going to be done with this type of propulsion system that people had been seeing really in mass since the 1920s and in even greater mass since the early 1940s, say about 1942. I had no idea that successful anti-gravity had been done until I discovered it in 1982 when I was in college in a book that actually my mom gave me called How to Build a Flying Saucer and Other Proposals in Speculative Engineering by T.B. Pawlicki. And that was published, I guess, in 1982. And I came across some information about inertialess propulsion and the Biefeld-Brown effect, and that it was a real electrogravitational effect of flying capacitors. And that was discovered back in 1927 by a 17-year-old Thomas Townsend Brown when he was playing around with an old Crookes X-ray tube. And at that point, I was like, wow, why are they not teaching this in school? Why are they not? If they had, I would have probably gotten a lot better grades. But why has this been glossed over? Why are they not talking about this? Why are we not doing this? Why is this not being taught? So I just, at that point, there was no Internet. So I went to the library, and I just dug and dug and dug and pages of popular science and sent away for patents. That actually there was a section in Popular Science or some other magazine that I saw in the mid-90s, and it said something about anti-gravity patents. So I ordered it, and there were all these electrogravitational patents that were in the public domain. Most of them, actually all of them, had expired, so anyone could build them. And I realized, my gosh, this is a whole area of really forbidden science or occult meaning hidden science that was perfectly valid and just as valid and just as undeniable as what they teach in our institutions of learning. And I realized, my gosh, if I learned enough about this, I could build these things myself, which I did. And they became all the rage, actually, in the early 2000s. And I realized, that, we could go into space and do the exact same thing that these cultures flying these UFOs were doing, only we could do it, we could do it ourselves. And it would reduce the cost and risk of space work by vast amounts and vast sums. And I thought, my gosh, this is just incredible. And in 1986, I came across another book called The Anti-Gravity Handbook, and it was compiled by David Hatcher Childress, who we see every week on Ancient Aliens. And I met him in 1994 at a Thomas Townsend Brown conference here in Philadelphia. And so in 1986, I realized, my gosh, this is incredible. This anti-gravity is real. And in the back of the book was a gold mine of bibliographical resources. And I determined that I was going to, try to get every single one of those resources. And in that book, I first heard about the Searle effect generator. And inside was a speculative proposal about how to build the generator and Biefeld-Brown effect work. And I just determined to, become learned in this area of technology.
How did you meet John Searle?
Well, that's another fortuitous and interesting happening. John Searle had been I've been a fan of his really since I discovered the work in 1986, and I had, you know, just been since the 80s, since the late 1980s, building large 2 foot and 3 foot diameter, 1 meter diameter, bifield ground horizontal propulsion saucers, and then later on, demonstrating them online in 1999, and then we were invited to the second anti-gravity conference in Reno, Nevada in the year 2000, and we demonstrated on YouTube that clip, the T.T. Brown electrokinetic apparatus. I replicated those flying discs right from the patent, first built them in 1990, but got them working in 98, 99 with a high-voltage power supply that I built. And in Reno, Nevada, in late June of the year 2000, we demonstrated them, and they became all the rage after that. Then the next year, I started building vertical lift propulsion devices that use slightly more amperage, but slightly less, a lot less voltage. I was flying these Biefeld Brown saucers with starting with 40,000 volts to 1.5 milliamps, and then later on about 100,000 volts to 120,000 volts at some tens of microamps, with a high voltage power supply I built from a kit from Information Unlimited. And I guess I made a name for myself because I had been going since 1990 to all these conferences on zero-point energy and Tesla technology. And I did my first lecture in 1990 at the Tesla Society conference in Colorado Springs. And I guess in 2006, I went to the Conference on Future Energy, where I saw that John Thomas, who had written Anti-Gravity, the Dream Made Reality, the story of John R.R. Searle, and I had seen a full-page cover story in Nexus magazine that had all about the inverse gravity, the Searle inverse gravity vehicle and the Searle effect generator and the law of the squares. So, of course, I bought that, and I ordered the videotape, the four-hour Munich lecture, and Law of the Squares, book four. And so in 2006, let me get back to 2006, leap forward in time. 2006, I went to the Conference on Future Energy, COFE 2, hosted by Tom Vallone of the Integrity Research Institute in Washington, D.C. Anyway, went to that, and I met Mr. John Thomas, who wrote Anti-Gravity, the Dream Made Reality, Story of John Searle, and Fernando Morris, who is the chief SEG engineer at our R&D facility in San Diego. And I must have asked a lot of pertinent questions and displayed my knowledge a little too much, because 1 year later, I got a call from Fernando Morris, who said, Professor Searle would like you to join our team. Well, the music to my ears, of course, and a dream come true, dream made reality. And I've been working with Professor Searle ever since, and now I'm working in a paid position full-time since this year. And I've helped to bring in money after my lecture in Holland last year. Tom Clearwater, an investor, basically funded us to a great deal of money, and help the effort to continue on and really expand. And we're having the best year ever because of that. And we're getting the work. We're R&Ding in California and here on the East Coast, in Florida, and up here in Pennsylvania. We're getting a lot of work done. And, gosh, we're getting a lot more done in the last few months than we have in the last few years. And everything is really taking off. And it's really gratifying. We've done a lot of radio shows. I got to work and lecture alongside Professor Searle in 2010. Professor Searle commissioned me to build a 1:1 scale IGV, which I did from styrofoam and polystyrene. It's basically 10-foot diameter, same size as one of the P-11 or P-6, P-12 craft that they flew, that the Searle National Space Research Consortium flew in Warminster and in Berkshire, England, mostly in Warminster. And that was a big hit. It was the honor of my life to be on the same stage with Professor Searle and lecture with him. And it's been a wild ride. And when this technology is brought to its conclusion, its development, and is deployed, all of humanity, all of Earth humanity, is going to get a wild ride. We're going to eliminate poverty and suffering, pollution, the energy crisis, which is really an artificial crisis, but we're going to do a lot to ameliorate global warming caused by excess use of fossil fuels, and we're going to have everything all electrical and a much cleaner, quieter, cooler, healthier world. Not only does this technology allow flight that is non-inertial and can go at any speed up to and beyond the speed of light because there's no inertia, but anything that runs on electricity, you can run on a domestic 2-foot diameter, 7-inch high Searle effect generator, or SEG. So this magnetic power source, a rotary, basically a rotary power source that gets its power from space itself, which is such an energy-rich medium, can also be used to fly craft at any speed we want. It opens up the whole universe to Earth humans. And what's even more stunning is that John Searle developed this technology when he was a boy. And when he was working as an apprentice electrician and fitter at British Rewinds and Repairs in London, at age 14, he said, well, these two dreams that I've been having for 6 years on and off from age 4 to age 10, I'm going to build this thing based on the instructions given in the dream. And the rest is history. But it's not history that's taught in our schools, just like the work of Thomas Townsend Brown that I replicated in the 1980s is not taught in our schools. And I've been redressing that oversight, whether deliberate or accidental, by being in school since 2002, helping kids win science fairs with electrogravitic technology. So, all things in good time. I think the world is ready for Professor Searle's technology now that we've reached a tipping point. It's now or never. We've got to do what we can to save our world and our planet and get mankind off the planet so we can let the Earth breathe again. And for our very survival, God forbid there's an asteroid or a comet or something similar, maybe even a biological event, a plague of some kind. We have to be able to get people off the planet so mankind can survive. And the way to get off the planet, obviously, is not going to be with something that's internal combustion. It's going to be with these fuel-less magnetic drives, of which the SCG is one. There's another one, of course, by Otis T. Carr. Ralph Ring worked with that technology. It's been called the poor man's Searle disc. So we are right on the cusp of a new golden age for all of Earth humanity. The whole economic system is going to be reset. Class is going to reemerge again, as it did in the late 40s.
You heard Catherine Austin Fitz talking about the breakaway economy. You're certainly a part of that. And I believe that it's time, because so much of this technology has been thwarted and shut down and hidden and purchased and scared off and, destroyed by those who are making themselves filthy rich off of fossil fuels, or what some call fossil fuels. I don't believe that oil is a fossil fuel, but we don't need to go there tonight. But the point is that this has been artificially kept out of the public eye. It's been deliberately squelched and held by certain people who control our media and our information and now our education and even our pulpits. And so, but now there's, like you said, we've reached a tipping point in more ways than one, I believe. And so I'll let you comment on that. But I believe that there's so many different people that are bringing forward these alternative energy methods and equipment and tools, that they're not going to be able to stop it anymore. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. I would also agree with my co-conspirator and lecturer, co-lecturer at Global BEM, Mr. Richard Dolan. Actually, we had the same flight back to the East Coast. But anyway, I've been a huge fan of his for a long time. And he talks about the breakaway civilization. Talk about a breakaway economy. There's a breakaway civilization. This technology and similar technologies, electromagnetic technologies, just as German scientists took the liquid-fueled rocket technology and primitive guidance systems of Robert Goddard in the 1920s, parenthetically, Robert Goddard had such successful work, but he couldn't get funding from the government. Well, the German government funded Hermann Oberth and other German scientists, Wernher von Braun, the German Rocket Society, and you can, you know, rest assured that they also borrowed the electromagnetic technology that Thomas Townsend Brown, T.T. Brown, discovered in the late 1920s when he was 17, and ran with that as well. So we see in Operation Paperclip, just after the war, a culling of the German scientists who were brought over. Some went to half of them went to the United States, the other half went to Russia, and soon after we had both countries doing ballistic missile work and space programs, manned and unmanned. Well, we also got their saucer scientists. We got scientists and people like Balanzo of Italy, Miethisch, Schriever, Habermal of Germany, also Victor Schauberger's electromagnetic work and also free energy work using his implosion tornado principle just from copying nature. Schauberger always said comprehend and copy nature, so that we see that these technologies have been secreted away by under layers and layers of above top secrecy by the military-industrial complex, which Eisenhower warned against just before he left office, and that we and understand that most of the UFOs seen since the 1940s and 50s have been earthly in origin because of that. Not all. Now, of course, what we can do, others elsewhere in the universe can also do. Electromagnetism acts the same way in all parts of the universe as far as we know. So we see that electromagnetic propulsion, which is artificial gravity propulsion, energy and mass are equivalent, both can bend gravity and space-time. We see that that has also been done by higher echelons within the military of many countries, not just the United States, and that this has been secreted away to protect vested interests and old families, and I know that many of your listeners will know the names of those old families, old European families that have guided our economic and political systems since a couple hundred years ago, and certainly since 150 years ago, and that we have a military breakaway civilization in Germany, the United States, Russia, Canada, England, South America, all over, and that crashes from extraterrestrial craft only confirmed earthly research and results. So we see that there is a breakaway civilization that has mastered this technology 70 years ago and has, you know, you can look at quotes from military brass that say we have, quote unquote, we have been to the edge of the universe or edge of the galaxy and back, utilizing whatever technologies they have a hold of. But you can be sure that they plundered the technology of Thomas Townsend Brown and then told him it couldn't be utilized, and did the same thing to John Searle, same thing to O.S.T. Carr, same thing to Hubbard. You could go on and on and on. Same thing to Floyd Sweet. But all of these technologies have one thing in common. Well, actually, a couple things in common. They're way over unity, and they interact with the zero-point energy of vacuum, and that's the quantum foam, the background energy of space-time, which is just unbelievable. 1 cubic meter of it or less would boil off all our oceans. Now, nature routinely coheres that energy, and Ilya Prigogine talks about it, his Nobel Prize winner for chemistry in 77, talks about it in his 1984 Bantam book, Order Out of Chaos, that he wrote with Isabel Fingers, and highly recommend that. And highly recommend any works by Wheeler, Gravitation by Wheeler, and Geometrodynamics by Wheeler. And I also recommend any of the works by Tom Bearden, including his new Tesla Scalar Electromagnetic series, where he emphasizes electrogravitics, transportation, and electrogravitic communication systems, which are known as scalar wave communication systems, which, depending on modulation, are below the speed of light or many, 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 many times above the speed of light. They're non-Hertzian. So what we're doing is bringing all this out into the open to be understood and used by the common man in the street, not just the military elites or the ultra, ultra 1% rich, but everyone, so we can make a better world, a better tomorrow, a better today for all the children and children yet unborn.
What about David LaPointe's work with the primer fields? Have you looked at that?
I have not had a chance to look at that, sorry to say. Just been so busy with the other things.
That's fairly recent. You know, he's been working with that vacuum chamber, and basically some of the things that he's done has kind of answered questions in the universe that had not previously been explained. In other words, there were some things that were they thought were anomalies that they just couldn't give an answer to scientifically, that his primer field concept has given very precise answers on. So it's a very interesting concept. I believe that what you're doing with the SEGs and the disc, et cetera, is related to that. And his work may actually answer some questions you may have had in your own mind about things that you're doing. So I'd recommend looking at that. But at any rate, we've got on with us Doug Millar, who is simulcasting during our first hour tonight on Crusade Radio, had his hand up, and I wanted to check in with him and see if he had a question for you that he wanted to cover before they go away in about 15 minutes. We've got an hour and 15 minutes, but his show only runs for about 15 more. He usually calls us back after he closes the show out. But, Doug, do you have a question?
No, it must be Jim Cook that put his hand up.
Yeah, my name is Jim Cook. I'm the co-host. We had talked earlier about the serial effect generator. Now, he uses devices in his cylinders that are non-magnetic, and he magnetizes them, and using the laws of squares, he has three different types of material in it, and I don't understand the concept fully, but it looks to me like he's using them like he would a capacitor in a dielectric state. The cylinder is going around the donuts in the middle of the serial effect SEG generator, and they're made from the same material, and they're layered in threes also. Is that the basic concept?
That's exactly right. The SEG could be thought of as a rotary capacitor. Now, we know from physics, advanced physics, well, even simple physics, well, I guess more advanced physics, that an object's spin connects it to its environment. Everything in nature is spinning. Everything in the universe is in motion, and that motion is a spin on an axis. Every subatomic particle, to say the most basic particles of an atom, proton, electron, neutron, they're spinning. And now it turns out that there's really no solid solidity to it. The solidity is an illusion caused by repulsion force fields from like charges. But basically those are vortexes, and they get their charge from the zero-point energy, which Wheeler contends are microscopic black holes and white holes popping into and out of existence at a very, very, very high frequency, you know, millions to billions of times a second. And those black holes and white holes basically channel electric flux from hyperspace into our little flatland slot. And that's random, but utilizing certain systems, devices and systems, many times rotary systems, as in nature, that energy, which is unbelievable and staggering, can be cohered for electrical and mechanical work.
Right. Now also, when I started studying Cyril's work and his law of squares, and they said that this produces like an ion field in the center as it increases its voltage, and then it becomes anti-gravity. Is that correct?
Partially. What happens is that electrons are radially flowing through the SEG in a plane, in the plane of the SEG. You're getting negative charges. The most mobile part of an atom, the electron, valence electrons basically, coming off the neodymium, which is a rare earth. We could use any rare earth in the SEG, but we've been using, Professor Searle had been using neodymium. Before that, and that was starting in 1946, before that, neodymium was just used by the glass blowing industry to polish glass and tint it a beautiful purple color. But the dreams that he had been having twice a year, two dreams twice a year over 6 years, told him the instructions, gave him the instructions for building the SEG. And one of the law of the squares, or the dream one, instructions given in dream one, says you must have a rare earth. You must have an element on the periodic table. It's the bottom of the periodic table. Well, it turns out rare earths make the most powerful magnets around. So Professor Searle could be thought of as the father of the rare earth magnets, and they're indispensable in today's society for everything from computer disk drives to Blu-ray players to machines used in hospitals to diagnose disease, and MRI machines and that sort of thing. But if you have
I'm going to give you... Oh, I'm sorry.
We're having the modules, the magnetic modules of the SEG, the stationary stators or rings, and the runners or rollers are electrically active, throwing off ions even without any relative movement. Rotation increases that effect markedly, and the faster the SEG runs by putting a load on it, the more load you put on it. Unlike conventional generators, the more load you put on them, the slower they run and the hotter they get. With the SEG, the SEG obeys the an-energy laws put down by Thomas Bearden in his Towards a New Tesla Scalar Electromagnetics work. The more load you put on the SEG, the reverse happens. It gets colder. It runs faster. And past a certain threshold of rotation, it gets lighter. At around 4 Kelvin, you overload it, and it's at 4 Kelvin, the neodymium, or whatever rare earth you're using in there, starts superconducting. And the earth, or any other source of gravity, repels it with irresistible force. It's physically impossible to hold it down. So after losing the first 6 SEGs in that manner, financed by the late George Haynes, Professor Searle said, you know, I just wanted a generator. This is kind of silly. Well, if it wants to lead us in the direction of flight, let's let it fly. Let's give it a body so we can control it. Obviously, the disk body is the ideal flight frame for control, and by gyro action and controlling the electrical potential around it, you can propel it in any direction, at any speed. It's inertialess. The slightest push sends it off at unbelievable speed with just a touch of control. And that's what we see in these types of propulsion systems, and that's what we've been seeing en masse since the early 1940s on this planet. Obviously, the Searle device is a copy of similar systems, whatever they're using.
Right. Now I noticed that Searle has kind of like, what I gathered from your introduction today, he's broken his business into two different factions, one building generators for off-the-grid houses to be able to produce electricity. And then the other one, aerospace, I take it, which I think you're involved with. Is that correct?
Yes, I'm involved with both, but I am CEO of Cyril Aerospace since a year ago.
Okay. Now, let me give you a little bit of my background. My name is Jim Cook. I do a lot of work for NASA. I have since 1988, on and off. I've actually
worked. Are you part of the Cook Drive, base drive, the rotary drive? It's similar to the Dean Drive.
No.
Cook Drive.
No.
Have you seen that book, The Death of Rocketry?
Oh yeah. Well, I noticed that Cyril had approached the government back in the 50s and Britain, and they entirely ignored it. And the reason being is because they've already had this technology, and they've had flight simulators for this type of technology since 1961, I think it was. So basically, and they've been keeping a secret, and the thing that you alluded to earlier, financial systems of the world have been keeping this information secret because they can't control the populace if they go off and start developing this and then compete head-to-head with them for financial control of these things. So they've been, same with the NASA space program, they've been shutting that down. And then on top of it, they've been keeping this stuff from us because their intent is control. And if we start developing this and become prosperous, we'll compete head with them. They want to control all manufacturing and finances in the world. So that's why your work and other people's work will get squelched, because they intend to have a war real soon and hopefully wipe out quite a bit of mankind. But I want to get away from that.
I heard that, and every time I hear that, I think, oh, God forbid, you know.
I've already stated there's a I used to be part of the Prophecy Club, and we had a PhD come through, Michael Kaufman, and he studied this quite extensively, and he says it is real. These people are sick in incredible ways.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they are aligned with demonic forces.
Absolutely.
And you can safely say that these people are not part of humanity as we know it. They are something subhuman, really, in the guise of walking, talking people.
There's a lot more of us than there are of them, and at this point, there's been some pretty good organized groups that have come together that are beginning to see and identify ways to bring this technology forward, regardless of what kind of pressure is put on because of the way and the funding and stuff that's going on. The cloud funding, for one, is one of the things that's really changing things in this breakaway economy. Would you agree with that, Russell?
I would agree with that, too. Yes, it's one thing that's helped a lot of really wonderful and much-needed things come into this world. I would also like to say that we've reached tipping points, and that disclosure has already happened. You can just look at the work by Foster Gamble and Thrive, and look at Stephen Greer's work at disclosureproject.org. He's included in his latest movie, Sirius, the Searle Effect Generator, and Professor Searle's work as obvious solutions that, we've had the at the National Press Club since 2001, brass from the military and corporations who have had firsthand experience with UFOs and UFO technology and propulsion and zero-point energy cohering systems. So, the cat is out of the bag, but it's still taught in our schools, strangely. So we have this strange duality, dichotomy in our civilization where, it's been covered up for a long time, but it's out. It's out. But yet it's still below the threshold of being everyday household talk. And I highly recommend that all your listeners go to disclosureproject.org and check it out.
Well, before Crusade Radio, folks, departs with us here in a couple of minutes, I just want to say thanks for joining us tonight. And, Jim, as always, you've come forward with some excellent, excellent questions. I had one question, Russell, and that is you've used the term magna kinetic. And, of course, I had to add that in my dictionary online.
Not magna kinetic, electrokinetic.
That's what I meant.
Yeah, and electrokinetic, it's just high voltage, low current. There's hardly enough current to make a magnetic field. Magnetic fields depend on moving charges, and this the Biefeld-Brown system is very high voltage but low amperage. Amperage is the current. My beam ships, my large models, I brought compass needles to them, and the needles don't deflect, even though they're flying and in the air. You tug on the tethers, and it feels like you're tugging on a helium balloon. You know, the needles don't deflect. There's not enough magnetic field.
That was them doing their closing on the Crusade Radio. You're okay.
Oh, okay, cool.
So what's the difference then between electromagnetic, which is what I was confusing a while ago, and electrokinetic?
Yeah, electromagnetic will have a strong magnetic component to it, and electrogravitic will have almost little to no magnetic field, probably no magnetic field. There's not enough current to form a magnetic field. The magnetic field depends upon moving charge, and with electrostatics, high-energy electrostatics, there's no moving charge. It's a flying capacitor or a moving capacitor. You can go in any direction depending on which way your positive charge is oriented. The vehicle will just chase after that positive charge into infinity as long as the impulse is maintained.
Would you like to take another caller's question?
Absolutely.
Area code 603. Ed, is that you?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
I hear you loud and clear. This is a friend of mine, Ed, who's one of our great freedom fighters here in the States, a part of the All States Organic Initiative, but also a very technically oriented fellow who has hit me with some questions that were over my head. So maybe you can challenge Russell, Ed.
Well, I don't have any challenges. It's just I'm curious about what updates he can give us on the progress of getting a working prototype of the SEG to show people that Professor Searle has got something earth-shaking to give to the world. And could you update us on how close we are to having a prototype that can be demonstrated?
Well, that's an excellent question, and my only response is it's hard to say. We're getting things together. We're getting closer all the time. We're getting our budgets together for our materials we need. It's not a cheap proposition to build the SEG as it was back in the day, where Professor Searle had access to machine shops and factories and trained personnel. We've been trying to build that from the ground up in California, Florida. We've got office R&D facilities in Florida. Also, I'm working full time on that. I'm working on getting materials for the SEG priced, to get it as low as price as possible. The costs of all the materials have risen markedly and dramatically since the work was done. First SEGs were built in the late 1940s and early 50s. It's been quite a job to get investors and source materials and locate factories and set up infrastructure at our R&D facility in San Diego. It's coming together, though. We've got a great team. We have affiliates and licensees in China now. I was at few other team Searle members and SEGC China, Searle Effect Group China, in Beijing a couple of months ago, actually 3 months ago, for the fourth annual Global Green Economy Prosperity Forum, where we demonstrated the Searle Effect with some magnetic motor mock-ups and eddy current demonstrators, eddy current repulsion demonstrators, and interest has never been higher. and awareness of the technology has never been higher, thanks to folks like Dr. Stephen Greer and Foster Gamble and others. And Professor Searle is still alive. The most amazing thing is I'm a huge fan of the man who gave us almost single-handedly our entire electrical 20th century over 100 years ago, Nikola Tesla. You can't talk to Nikola Tesla. You can't talk to Thomas Townsend Brown. You can't talk to Stanley Meyer. But you can talk to Professor John Searle. He's alive and kicking, working hard in England every day to help us, to help the effort. And he is just the most dear man you'd ever want to know. And he's the friend to all humanity. He cares more about all of us, all of humanity, than himself. And you can't say that about too many people.
Okay, well, the only other thing that was on my mind, the last that I knew that I was seriously looking at the progress that was being made was that I guess you were trying to get a magnetization of the rollers. Now, I thought I heard earlier you said that perhaps that they're not magnetized, or there was a special magnetization process or a technique that had to be perfected for mass manufacturing on the rollers. Is that correct?
For any manufacturing, even the prototype, it's a proprietary magnetization system that could be called magnetic bubbles, and they're laid out in sine wave patterns on the plates and the runners. And without spilling the beans, I'll just say that magnetization is critical. And once you get that, the thing will self-motor. And the roller, once one roller is presented to a plate, it will just instantly jump to cruising speed. So that's very important. Another thing is getting the proportion of materials right according to the numerical system, law of the squares, from which this technology is derived.
Okay, so it's not the rollers that are magnetized, it's the plates, the round rings.
The plates and the runners have the same pattern on them. Two sine waves, 90 degrees out of phase.
Right.
Basically a two-phase motor, very simple two-phase motor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's also, don't forget, ions flowing through the SEG, even when it's stationary, and rotation enhances that effect. So you have an electrical EMF current and a voltage going through the SEG. And, of course, what happens when you have a voltage in the presence of a magnetic field? You get a force called a Lorentz force, which results in an electric motor.
Right.
So it's pretty simple, but infuriatingly complex, and that's the Searle effect.
So it's a matter of getting the material sciences to the point where they can be manufactured economically.
Prototypes cannot be manufactured economically. Once they're mass manufactured, the cost comes way down to the point of affordability, and it would be not much more costly than a furnace unit or a heating and cooling unit in a home. Be probably about that same cost, anywhere from $2,500 up to $15,000-$20,000 for a domestic or automotive Searle effect generator. Anything that can be run on electricity at any voltage or current you want in any country can be run utilizing the Searle effect generator. There's no friction in the device. It won't wear out. You can pass it down to your grandkids. It's really a harnessing of systems that we see all the time in nature, similar to what Victor Schauberger discovered by simply observing nature and then copying nature.
So for example, I've heard Tom Bearden talk about their motionless magnetic generator that he says would be mass-produced once all of the nonlinear electrodynamics are worked out and the material science to make them occur in a mass-produced manner are worked out, and he says that would take, you know, $a few million and some bright engineering students, engineering graduates to get done. And from what I gather, that's not as big an issue with the SEG. Is that correct?
It's about the same. It's about the same. But it's taking a little less than $a few million. We first thought it would take, $3 million perhaps to get the effort going. But we realized after budgeting, some initial budgeting, that it's going to take a little less. But still, I mean, it takes money to keep the lights burning at our facilities until we have the SEGs, of course, and, pay the people, buy the materials, buy the machines and industrial devices that we need to build the SEG. We have a great facility in San Diego. We have more facility in Florida, and everybody's working toward the same goal, to rebuilding this technology that was ruthlessly suppressed about 30 years ago, a little over 30 years ago, and gone up dramatically since then. But it's not going to take quite as much money as we thought, but still takes a bit of money. I mean, we're always seeking investors to help make this happen, and it's going to happen. It's, as my fiancé would say, fiancé Marianne would say, it's already here. And that is the secret to manifestation. You see it everywhere.
Right.
Well, you're a lucky man, Russell, to have such a lovely lady as your partner there. I got to meet her, too, and, boy, what a joy to be around.
I agree. She's the one. She's my angel. Yeah.
Let's bring Red Beckman in here for just a moment, because I know what Red's going to do. Red likes to bring things down to that fourth grade level so that the average common man can understand it. Red, you've been listening to this for a long time and being quiet. Unmute yourself and come in here and introduce yourself to Russell Anderson, because I really didn't properly introduce you guys at the beginning of the show. Red's been in this fight for a long time, Russell. I hope you're familiar with him. He's in his 80s and has really, well, even was in our minds, the name of this show came from one of his little books. So I'd like for you to be able to say hello to Red now.
Hi, Red. How you doing?
Well, I'm trying to find a cure for 85 years.
Oh, my. Well, stick around. You just may get it pretty soon.
This is so fascinating to me because my family on my father's side were inventive. My father worked for the Ford Motor Company after he got out of the service in World War I, and he invented an improvement on the Model T carburetor. And over the years, we have done some things. My younger brother and I, we had some patents on some tools that the market analysis said that the world market should be $1 billion a year. However, our patent protection and our imports and everything, people were building what we were planning on. They were building it in a backyard shanty in Formosa or someplace in the Orient, and shipping them in here, and we weren't being protected by our import people and such, and it was it was kind of a frustration. However, that's just my background, and so I have seen a lot of this coming, and I think I heard something there about some of this this enemy that we have that has held us back from developing a lot of this. Alfred Lawson, do you recognize that name?
No, sorry to say I do not.
Alfred Lawson, Terry can tell you about it if you talk to him off the program. I won't bring it up, but Alfred Lawson had a lot of the patents on early airplanes. He built the first passenger airliners and that type of thing. And he called the alien financiers. And they have been a problem, but I see the end of that. I see that coming to an end. And as I was listening here, I was thrilled. I was just absolutely thrilled. I probably only caught somewhere less than 10% of what you're talking about. But it was a thrill because I see something happening, something coming. That is very, very, very exciting. And so my hat is off to you, and I just wish I was 30 or 40 years younger because I would be involved with both feet and really join with you because you're talking about some very exciting things. And our Heavenly Father was a great creator, and he created us in his likeness, which means we were to be creative as well. And
Whatever God is, our thoughts and feelings are made up of the same thing.
And I heard something else. You said that the rare earth magnets are the strongest that they've ever found.
Professor Searle was the author of those rare earth magnets at the age of 14 in 1946. And and that's something imagine. Well, Thomas Townsend Brown discovered electrogravitics when he was 17 in 1927. So it seems like the young people, whatever era you're talking about, the young people are more experimental and adventurous and hunger for new knowledge. And eventually it filters into society or not. But you can see that electrogravitics finally made its way into society by the early 21st century, even though it was discovered 80 years ago. Or over 80 years ago, it's maybe it's God saying now's the time.
That's what it is, I'm sure. Are you familiar with the Nikon magnets that the Japanese use for health purposes?
That sounds vaguely familiar. Yes, I have heard of them. Yes, I have heard of
them.
Well,
there's an area there that there could be some things happening there. I had a serious go around with a breathing problem back in the 90s. It had been with me for quite a long time, and I was asthmatic, and I was on two prescription inhalers and that type of thing. It was really slowing me down. In the mid-90s, and then somebody recommended that I try these magnets, and I hung a couple of those magnets around my neck on my chest, and within 24 hours, I was breathing, and I've had nothing since then. Now, I don't know what happened to the inhalers, because I didn't need them, and so I really believe there's another area there.
Yeah, well, the magnets can rejuvenate you and make you younger. If you have gray hair, if you wear magnetic rings on your fingers and toes at night when you go to sleep, your hair will return to its normal color and your skin may become smoother. you know, it's basically getting more oxygen and nutrients into your hemoglobin and your red blood cells, which you don't normally get. So the body is magnetic. The body is also electric. So you can see that properly influenced electromagnetic fields at the proper frequency, and that key is the proper frequency, can rejuvenate your health. The proper polarity or frequency. The Solar Effect generator, for example, puts out cold current and a negative state electricity. All our current systems from DC to AC are positive polarity electricity, and that is not healthy. What we want is what we get after a thunderstorm, or the air that we have up in the mountains, or down by the seashore, or by a waterfall. That we want those negative ions, and the Solar Effect generator could be thought of as a negative ion generator on steroids.
Some people are even finding that walking barefoot on the earth will have a similar effect, which is really interesting, because we've all been ungrounded, if you will, with what we wear on our feet.
We've been insulated, yes.
Russell, I want to acknowledge, I believe Jim Cook's called back in, he's got his hand up, but I don't want to bring him in yet because he's going to go highly technical again, and I'm going to bring you in a minute, Jim, but I just want to get this in. I'm going to really challenge you now, Russell. This may be the toughest thing you do in this call, I don't know. Some of our listeners don't know the difference between north and south in polarity. They don't know really how a magnet functions particularly. They certainly don't know where the source of this energy is coming from that you're talking about capturing with a SEG. I'm just wondering if you can back up for just a minute, like you're talking to some kid or somebody that doesn't have any scientific knowledge, and give them a little bit of an explanation they might be able to understand on how an SEG or a magnetic power generator works.
Well, first you have to understand what magnetism is, what permanent magnetism is, and what electricity and electric current is. Well, you know how you have atoms and you have normally electrons are going at the speed of light at a very, 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 very small distance around an atom, and normally they're going in random orbits all over the place, these electric charges, these negative charges called electrons that are orbiting and spinning, not unlike the rollers of an SEG or the planets. But once something is permanently magnetized, say a ferromagnetic substance like iron, carbonized iron or some kind of iron with a rare earth, once something is magnetized, or even semi-permanent magnetism like soft iron, once that's magnetized, all those random electrons that are normally orbiting to the nucleus, close to the nucleus of those substances, instead of going all over the place, they are now in the same plane once they're magnetized. Those electrons are orbiting the nucleus of the atom, which is positively charged. They're orbiting in the same plane, not unlike the planets in the plane of the ecliptic. Now, once that happens, you have basically a solenoid loop. You've cohered magnetic force, and you have permanent magnetism, or as in the case of an electromagnet, temporary electromagnetism under the influence of an electrical field. So we could also go even deeper and see that what we have in the universe or in the spaces between atoms of a substance, which are huge, all matter is mostly empty space. The volume of protons and electrons and neutrons in a substance is very, very small, a very small percentage. It's mostly empty space. But space is not empty. We see that space is filled with an energy-rich medium that Tom Bearden calls, and I agree with this, a Lorentz invariant non-material ether. Back in the 19th century and before, it was speculated that there had to be some plenum substance that pervaded all of space-time that allowed the transmission of light. And, of course, electromagnetism, electromagnetic waves, which Tesla made use of to bring radio into being. So we have this ether, which could be thought of as an ultra-fine gas. You could think of it as made up of particles so small as to have no detectable mass. But you can compress it. You can expand it. It's the ether. Michelson-Morley did a failed experiment because they thought there might be just a static ether. Instead, there's a dynamic ether, which quantum physics and higher physics acknowledges and concedes is going much faster, flowing through space, much faster than the speed of light. So we could think of magnetic fields as ether currents that basically go spiraling in faster than the speed of light, and Oblensky agrees. He wrote the magnetic force is faster than the speed of light. Also, the gravitational force is faster than the speed of light, many millions of times faster than the speed of light. We see that magnetic fields are nothing more than ether currents, where we have a spiraling vortexian flow on the north pole of a magnet, no matter how small. At the center point of the magnet, the block wall, the flow reverses direction, and you get a south pole at the other end of the magnet. Now, magnetic fields then are nothing more than ether currents, totally understandable. Gravitational force could be thought of as a converging flux of ether upon matter, and the more dense that localized mass is, the greater the flux of ether. Or, in conventional physics, the more the bending of space-time. So we see that also energy, electromagnetic energy, as well as mass, since they're equivalent according to Einstein, both can bend space-time. You can bend space-time with either a high localized concentration of dense mass or a high densely localized concentration of energy. They're equivalent. So since the electrical field can produce gravitational force as well as magnetism, we see that the unifying field is the electrical field. And that's pretty much it. I could get more complex, but you get the idea pretty much. Look at papers by Oblensky. Look at any works by Wheeler, his books, Gravitation and Geometrodynamics. Highly recommend those. Any of the new Tesla Scalar Electromagnetics series by Thomas Bearden, highly recommend his work. Been a big fan of his for 30 years. You get to see that once you understand that gravitational force is nothing more than a converging flux of ether, then we can build systems that will allow us to engineer gravitational force for things as mundane as artificial gravity on board a spacecraft. Make your spacecraft a capacitor, and the displacement current inside the capacitor could be your onboard gravitation. Or for propulsion, as in the Biefeld-Brown effect, and the Searle effect, Otis T. Carr's devices that Ralph Ring worked on, and I met Ralph Ring and his wife last year at the Global BEM1 in Hilversum, Holland. You can see that once you see that ether is real, which they do not teach in our schools. You got to look at other experiments like Silvertooth Saganac and others that confirm the existence of a non-stationary ether. You realize that, hey, you know, they threw the baby out with the bathwater when they dispensed with ether in relativity. However, relativity was not apparently understood correctly. Einstein is quoted in another lecture years and years later as saying that relativity depends on the presence of an ether to do mechanical things like provide a medium for waves, electromagnetic waves such as light and radio waves in space. In fact, Nikola Tesla derided relativity and thought that relativity was just nonsense. And we see that Nikola Tesla built and patented our whole electrical 20th century with over 700 fundamental patents, most of which we still use today. And Nikola Tesla said, basically, there is an ether. All of my inventions depend on its existence.
Well, let me throw this at you. Something that's made sense to me lately is amending the terms north and south and amending the terms positive and negative and starting to think about it rather as in and out. And I noticed that with the SEG, you've got the neodymium on the inside of the what appear, you know, you could call it a donut. It's the stationary donut that's a central part of the SEG. You could refer to that neodymium as the in part where the energy is traveling in or is being captured, if you will. And then you've got the magnetic portion and the insulator, and then you've got the copper on the outside of that with the rollers on the outside of that copper. And the copper is like an emitter where the energy is going out. Would that be an accurate description?
That's completely accurate. Yes, the innermost neodymium portion of the SEG could be thought of as both the electron collector and the electron reservoir. And what happens in rare earth materials, unlike most other materials, rare earths are metals, so they have a very large conduction band, no forbidden zone. There are a couple of extra valence electrons on the outer 4F and 5F band shells of rare earth materials, and those are freely mobile, and rare earths greedily suck up electrons and readily emit those electrons. So knowing that, we make the neodymium, our innermost layer as an electron collector, and we have what we see is electrons or pre-electrons. Think of the ether, these little particles of vacuum that Tom Bearden talks about, as housing enormous quantities of harder electrons, which normally surround every atom, and a flow of which we call electric current, which we need for our civilization. Now, when the SEG, even if it's not moving, electrons or pre-electrons, which are could be called etherons, vacuum particles, are flowing in a vortexian action into that centermost layer, the neodymium layer. And one electron from the neodymium and one electron from free space pair and form a boson pair or a Cooper pair, and they tunnel through the materials of the SEG, and the SEG materials go lighter as you go out, the neodymium being the heaviest elements at the bottom of the periodic table. So you have a boson pair. Normally, those electrons want to repel each other with irresistible force following the inverse square law. The intensity of the force drops off inversely with the square of the distance. What you see instead is pair production of boson pairs, two electrons. And when they hit that magnetized layer, electrons want to follow lines of magnetic force, as you know. So they start spiraling in tighter and tighter and tighter, even though they're the same polarity, just like a figure skater pulling their arms in and then spinning faster and faster. So they gain velocity and spin, which means also they're gaining electrical energy. And they're going through the materials, and then the copper emitter layer on the very most outside layer of each of the plates and runners, that's always negatively charged. The neodymium layers of the plates and runners are positively charged, and a copper or aluminum, you got to use a conductive but paramagnetic element on the outside, outer layer of the plates and runners is negatively charged. So you get positive, negative, positive, negative, positive, negative, positive, negative from the inner to the outermost layer. And, of course, you generate electricity from the SEG in the conventional way by putting induction coils around it, and it generates electricity in the conventional manner by cutting lines of magnetic force with a conductor. You can either move the conductor or move the magnetic field. And, of course, the SEG is moving the magnetic field.
Okay, Walter Russell, I believe, was the one that talked about the standing wave and referred to that energy as being at rest. And obviously, you just talked about how high speed it's moving and that it's not to say that it's at rest, I think, would be a misnomer, but it perceptively, it appears to be at rest until you afford it the opportunity or provide the opportunity for it to move, or instead of moving, perhaps changing the way it moves. Do you have an opinion about that and what's happening with the SEG?
Yeah, and I agree with Walter Russell's work. His work is fundamental. And it's very, very important to understand what's really going on fundamentally in these natural systems and artificial systems, which people like Victor Schauberger and John Searle and even Nikola Tesla have used to copy systems found in nature. That I wouldn't necessarily say that it's the background energy of space-time is static. I would say it's dynamic. It's moving. And it's moving many, 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 many times faster than the speed of light, according to conventional physics as well. And it's funny, conventional physics, had been of the opinion that the speed of light is a barrier, as the Einsteinian light barrier, that, things, would get so heavy once you move past the speed of light in inertialess systems, such as the SVG and Thomas Townsend Brown flight systems. There's no inertia, so you don't get heavier. The speed of light shouldn't be a barrier to flight means such as those. And in that, and indeed, that's what we see. Once you have a system that generates gravity, artificial gravity electromagnetically, the speed of light is no longer a barrier any more than the speed of sound is a barrier to Chuck Yeager in the Bell Aerospace X-1 rocket plane back in 1947.
Can we go back to the phone lines? Russell?
Yes, sir.
May I go back to the phone lines? We've got about 25 minutes left. I want to get...
Hold on. Whatever you need.
Area code 434. Jim, is that you?
Yeah, it is. Hi. Basically, you said a few things that I want to touch upon. Well, just recently at a university, they discovered that in the 1,500 hertz sound range, that it goes something like 10 times the speed of light. That's number one. Two, I've done a couple of satellites for NASA. One was called SOHO back in the 90s, or actually late 80s, 90s. It was Solar Heliospherical Observatory to study
the sun. I've heard of that one, yes.
Okay, and recently SDO was launched in 2010, Solar Dynamic Observatory. I worked at Goddard on that one. Here's what I'm about to say. What happens is we've discovered by observing the sun that it is neither nuclear nor fission. It is an electrical process.
I would agree with the electric sun analogy. Yes, very important.
Right, and on top of that, you're right. And they discovered the ether back during the late 1800s. Nikola Tesla and Marconi in their
radio. Radio is Tesla called radio like sound waves, basically rarefactions and compressions in the ether. Not unlike sound waves or rarefactions and compressions in a fluid medium like air or water.
Correct. And it was actually Nikola Tesla was out to give everybody free energy until Carnegie got upset with that fact. And
J.P. Morgan, wanted to crucify him because of that, basically.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, he sent his men out and tore down his tower.
Well, yeah, absolutely, and that site you sent me to about the Bushes being German, they stole a lot of money from his work and kept him poor, and they did that so that he could not have made the money to make his visions come true. So basically,
yes, such as Wardenclyffe Tower, the Tesla magnifying transmitter, which would have provided radio and electrical power through the earth or through the air to anyone anywhere on earth.
And also, Nikola Tesla, remember the Tunguska blast?
Oh, yes.
Tunguska force?
1908.
Well, correct. Well, what I read was this. Nikola Tesla had developed plasma energy, and he wanted to show it to the world. So what he did in an experiment, he was going to refract it off our ionosphere back down to the North Pole to see if it worked. Well, he miscalculated, and it ricocheted off the ionosphere and came back down in Tunguska. And the strangest thing about that story is that when you start reading on the Tunguska blast, you'll find out that they thought it was a meteor that blew up, but they could not find any fragments anywhere. So it leads credence to the fact that Nikola Tesla had succeeded in what he did. He just miscalculated instead of having it come down in a place where nothing was, like the North Pole. It refracted and came down in Tunguska. Now, the way the trees were laid out, it was, if this were a plasma blast, it would have come down, hit, and everything would have blasted in a radial section. We don't see that happening with meteors. With meteors, you get cratering, but this, there was no real crater. It was just a plasma blast that took everything down in a radial direction. So Nikola Tesla was far advanced. Now, also, one other thing, he created this device that he put on a car that he drove from New Jersey up to Niagara Falls and back. And it was a small device because he held it in his hands, and he put it in the car. The car operated. It operated
the Pierce arrow.
Right, exactly. So the bottom line is all this technology has been kept from us because once society got a hold of it, we would be free from the clutches of their controlling. And
it would bring about true freedom. One thing I would like to possibly differ with you on the cause of the Tunguska blast. That it was it was directed downward. The trees at the ground zero basically were standing straight up, not unlike the atomic bomb dome at the hospital at the center of the Hiroshima blast. We see the same thing over a nuclear explosion directly at the epicenter or hypocenter of the blast, ground zero. Trees will be still standing up, but all the other trees outside a certain radius will be laid out in a radial fashion. There's a lot of evidence and witnesses to suggest that the Tunguska blast was caused by either a malfunctioning or deliberately self-destructing alien spacecraft.
Well, that's one theory, but also, in kind of like a counter to that, what our military personnel have discovered is that these things come in and out of the ether or in or out of dimensional, and they believe
yes.
These things are satanic in nature because every time they meet with them, they just get more and more evil. So I do believe there is space travel possibility, and there may be real aliens, but the ones that we're in touch with that these supposed elitists have been talking to are of the evil kind, and they're getting ready to liquidate a lot of people off the face of this planet. And those two nuclear weapons that left the Texas air base and disappeared without paperwork might be used for a false flag, which they're intending to ignite a war with Syria and Iran and involve Russia and China and to reduce the population of the world. This is how they're going to try to control the populace, by first eliminating the number of people and then controlling the technology. So you're right. It could give us great freedom. It could give us untold wealth for everyone. No one would be starving on this planet. And the bottom line
is we could bring about a golden age, which has been prophesized as the age of Aquarius, where, you know, no one is suffering anymore. There's no more war, no more crime, no more disease. People are living in love and harmony as the Creator intended. if indeed there was a creator. We could go either way. And it looks like with the young people of today, they want to go the way of peace, love, and free energy and unlimited space travel.
Well, you're absolutely right, and I do know that there is a creator because I met Jesus personally. Not like I'm talking to you, like I was standing in the same room. But the bottom line here is, I don't know if you've heard about Nibiru. It was caught on a couple of the instruments that I worked on.
Say that again, please.
Nibiru?
Oh, yeah, I've heard about that, yeah. Of course, yeah.
Well, that's where the fallen angels came from, because there's seven planets, and it's the second sun to our solar system.
Yeah, you're talking about the Anunnaki.
Correct.
Wait,
and
Jim,
that's where... Yes?
Jim, throw that bird a cracker, will you?
Oh, I can't say that. He's his own... Well, he's eating right now, so hopefully he'll be quiet. But, you know, it really... A lot of this boils down to ancient prophecy, and the fallen angels actually were known for giving all the technology to mankind back during before Noah's time.
Before written history, basically.
And a lot of this technology, okay, about the ether and the electrical universe and how power comes from all directions at the same time, which was discovered before we realized that the sun was an electrical reaction. It all boils down to, yeah, you're absolutely right. So was Nikola Tesla. And I would like to be as positive as what the outcome is going to be, but we won't put with mankind, with these people in the way for us, because they don't think like us. They're totally evil, and they're going to be destroying our world before we get a chance to bring out this technology.
Well, let's hope not. Let's hope that those of us who are working with technology redouble our efforts to get it out as fast as possible to preclude that, and we can totally turn things around, prove ourselves worthy of existing in the universe as a cosmic people.
I agree.
Well, Russ, that brings us back to the practical aspect of where is Searle going soon, and what should we expect coming out of the Searle team, and do we have any kind of timelines? You know, when we met a couple months ago, one of the things that I said to you was that if you got an SEG ready to go into production, I'm ready to start installing them. I got another contractor this morning that contacted me out of Arizona that about to put in a $50,000 solar system, and if I could provide them with a magnetically powered generator system or charging system, they would opt to go with that if we could give them something that was in production. And so that's where I'd like to spend this last 15 minutes. What's our practical expectation?
Well, it's hard to say what the timeline is because there's so many variables involved in recreating any technology, especially one as complex as this. It's simple, yet it's complex. To really get it to work properly, you have to follow the instructions given in those dreams exactly. Marcus Hollingshead replicated the SEG some years back, and it burned up. Released a tremendous exothermic reaction. That's not what we want. We want an endothermic reaction. That's how the SEG normally operates in a land of cold. Also, Paul Brown of NuCell built an SEG, and his SEG did the same thing and melted the feed wires that were, of course, to get it going, you put a load on it. So that we have a couple of working SEGs that burned up. We have a copy of the SEG done by Russia, Roshan and Godin, back in 1996, and passed a certain threshold speed that ran on its own, and it developed a 35% weight loss at a very leisurely 550 to 600 RPMs. Now, the SCG runs far faster than that when it's overloaded and superconducted. We also have the Morningstar Energy Box people who were at COFI 4 that I wasn't at. I was at COFI 2 and 3 in Washington, D.C., and their work is based on Professor Searle's work and other magnetic converters, but most notably Professor Searle's SCG, Searle Effect Generator. So we have other semi-successful replications of the work that are tangential with Searle Effect technology. So that only buoys and confirms that we're on the right track, and you know, we're just redoubling our efforts. And I'm working hard every day, you know, probably working too many hours. When we were over in China, I noticed that one thing, you know, we're demonstrating Searle Effect technology. One of the things that I noticed was that the Chinese people have a philosophy, and their philosophy basically says balance in all things, and that's the key to a happy life and the key to success. I got to get more balance in my life. I got to, you know, not be working so much to the exclusion of all else, music, fun, family, friends, entertainment, and exercise, and, you know, the SEG will happen, but, you know, you gotta give yourself some time off, otherwise you implode, and we can't have that, obviously.
Well, some of these other folks out there, like Orlowski and the folks up in Canada, whose name I won't mention at the moment, those folks are actually in the production at this point, but their systems seem to require that the energy go somewhere or it will shut it down. And their controllers are becoming a very critical element so that you don't overcharge batteries with it or so that you don't damage the equipment. How are you guys in that range? Is that
it sounds like those systems are getting some kind of back EMF. Sounds like they're getting a back EMF in the systems. But the SEG, you just have to do things correctly according to the laws of physics, most notably Ohm's law. The law of conservation of energy is not broken. The law of conservation of energy says energy cannot be created or destroyed, only changed in form. Well, we're converting this random turbulent flux of zero-point energy or ether into cohering it, into usable electrical energy and torque. So, you just really have to study systems in nature and, like Victor Schauberger said, comprehend and copy nature.
Can you give our listeners just a quick, brief lesson on what zero point means?
Yeah, zero point means at basically absolute zero, you're still getting a jitter of particles at the subatomic level. And that jitter could be thought of as a sine wave or an energetic wave, and that sine wave or energetic wave of vacuum jitter can be tapped for unbelievable electrical energy. There can never be a zero energy, so the term zero-point energy is kind of a misnomer. But basically, at zero degrees, you still got tremendous energy going on at the subatomic level, at the subquantum level.
Compare that to over-unity, please.
Yeah, over-unity is where you're getting more energy out than you're putting in. In terms of the SEG, the energy that is being put in is invisible, like all energy, but it's coming from the background of space-time. So you can't really talk, it's kind of a misnomer to talk about the SEG as over-unity, but I guess you could, because the more load you put on the SEG, the more electricity, let me get a little drink here, the more electricity you can get out of it, and past a certain point, it's overloaded and superconducting. The neodymium starts superconducting, or whatever rare earth you're using in there, starts superconducting, and you've opened the vacuum floodgates, and the amount of energy you can get out of there is basically unlimited. It's been measured, the inverse gravity vehicle at flight voltage is some 10 to the 12th volts. That's a trillion volts, a teravolt. So you can see that once overloaded and superconducting, the vacuum floodgates seem to be just open wide, and you know, you can tap this limitless energy that's all around us 24 hours a day, inside of matter and in all of space-time.
Well, Ed, you're still live, and Jim, you're still live. I'm going to give each one of you guys one more question to Russell, and then I'm going to let him close it out by telling us whatever he'd like for the listeners to hear. Ed, you got another question?
Caught me off guard. Nothing comes to mind. It's just I can't wait to for the, you know, it'll be a great day when the, when it's announced the working prototype to suck up the investors like crazy.
Won't need them then. Yeah, whoever even has a little bit
of an investment is going to realize some tremendous profits beyond all dreams of avarice.
Jim, one last question.
Yes. When I first read about his saucers going through the roof and out into outer space, later on it said in the article that they found a way to control it using frequency. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. One way was by accident on a Canadian TV program where the SCG was being demonstrated. And at one point, you know, it was an old, around 1969, 1970, old-fashioned big TV camera panned down to the plane of the SCG, and the SCG slowed and came to a stop. They had never been able to figure out how to stop them before. Once they were set in motion, you know, they were just on their own, and there would be no way to shut them down. They would just be left running. So the camera then panned up to catch Professor Searle's face, which was a look of utter shock and amazement with mouth open and everything, then panned down to the SCG. At that point, Professor Searle realized that the oscillator tube on the video camera, old-style video camera, was introducing an artificial pole, magnetic pole, electromagnetic pole, on the outer set of runners just passing nearest the camera, which introduced equilibrium into the system. Well, of course, when you have equilibrium, you have magnetic lockup. Nothing moves. The whole reason the SCG wants to move is disequilibrium, the poles, the little north-south poles or magnetic bubbles laid up in a sine wave on the plates and the same frequency sine wave on the runner, just 90 degrees out of phase with the wave on the plates. You got to have two fields at 90 degrees or it won't work. So the whole reason it works is the disequilibrium set up by those two fields. Well, at 90 degrees out of phase, that's a two-phase motor. The two separate fields, the two separate sine waves, one on x-axis and one on y-axis, when they're brought together, create a rotating field, a rotating magnetic field. And if you remember that Nikola Tesla came up with the idea of the rotating magnetic field that gave us polyphase AC power, you know, 150 years ago, and gave us our whole electrical 20th century with AC power.
He was also the inventor of the oscillator. That's what almost caused an earthquake in his New Jersey lab.
Yes, in New York, in his Houston Street laboratory, the mechanical oscillator. But so you have this rotating wave, and the runners or rollers are simply carried along in the troughs of this rotating wave like a surfboard.
Now, I got one other question. How do you use the frequency to change direction or attitude,
you don't use frequency to change direction or attitude. What you have are these things called flight cells, and the SCG basic structure is 64 struts, and in between each of the struts at the rim or near the rim, in between the outer SCG housing wall and the rim or flame barrier, are flight cells, 64 flight cells in between each of the struts. And they basically control the SCG like a gyro. If you touch gyro, that portion of the gyro that you touch is slowed down a very, very small amount. That's enough to make that drop. And also you have little switches that control the polarity to the isolated, normally isolated upper and lower shells that are normally connected to the innermost positive layer of the SEG, the drive SEG. Now, when they're activated, those flight cells are normally in plane with the device flip 90 degrees from 0 degrees to 90 degrees. At the same time, through the hollow shaft that it rotates on, fires with a solenoid a hard rubber pin through a hole in the outer SEG housing wall. At that point, that 1/64th or 1/4, if you use 16 flight cells simultaneously, of the SEG's of the IGV craft is forced to drop. And if that drop is maintained, the craft flies off directly in the direction of that drop rapidly. And so you can use that very simple flight control system to change the attitude of the craft. Also, there's 64 rim needles or rim discharge pins that control the polarity discharge, which is normally negative, out of the rim. And if you change that section, reverse that polarity, or just stop the polarity, stop the electrical negative charge, you'll get a reverse positive charge. And, of course, just like the Biefeld-Brown effect, you'll go off very rapidly in that direction, too. And since there's no inertia, you go off at a tremendous speed with just a touch of control. There's no limit to the speed as far as we know.
Russell, 30 seconds. You've got 30 seconds to share whatever you want to share with our listeners.
Well, if you want to learn more about Searle technology, go to swallowcommand.com, searleeffect.com, searleaerospace.com, searlesolution.com, SearleMagnetics.com, and go on YouTube and go to the Global Breakthrough Energy Movement sites, globalbem.com, and learn about Searle technology and other tangential technologies that will turn our world into what everyone wants.
Russell, this has been great. We are out of time. Thank you so much. Man, this has been a great show. It went so fast. Red, have a good night and a good Christmas. Jim, Ed, thanks for joining us and contributing to the questions tonight. And we'll see you all next week on Walls in Our Minds.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
Did you know that your baby boy would one day walk on water? Mary, did you know that your baby boy would save our sons and daughters? Did you know that your baby boy has come to make you new? Child that you delivered will soon deliver you. Mary, did you know that your baby boy will give sight to a blind man? Mary, did you know that your baby boy will calm the storm with his hand? Did you know that your baby boy walked where angels trod? When you kiss your little baby, you kiss the face of God. Oh Mary, did you know? Yeah. that your baby boy would one day rule the nation. Did you know that your baby boy is heaven's perfect lamb? The sleeping child you're holding is the greatest.